Confusion matrix.
Okay, we're rolling. Hello, Pete. How are you today? I feel it's become customary to start off talking about the weather. So how are you today, and how is the weather in the part of the country that you are in?
I am well, and I can see large yellow orb in the sky, occasionally even by white clouds. It's like an episode of The Simpsons.
Yeah, well, I don't have the cloud. I've just got blue sky and the big, mysterious, glowing orb. And it's really rather pleasant, and I have my office here is at the wrong side of the house for the sun. So it doesn't actually get direct sun on it at all. And so this room is always quite chilly, and I just walked out the back door earlier on, and it was just like, oh, it's really warm out here. It's really quite pleasant. It's quite summery, it's quite springy. But I'm in this office, freezing my nuts off.
Been kept in the dark and fed, all that sort of stuff.
Well, that's right. At some point, my wife's going to wait for me to go in here, stick an outside lock on the door, right? And then just lock me in like the ogre that I am, and maybe carve a little hole in the door, post me through the odd bit of food, the odd pot noodle or something. Life as an analyst and a data scientist, we don't see the sunshine.
Indeed.
Sun shines for the other people, the real important people. We're like the ones in the time machine that live underground.
Yeah, Morlocks.
The Morlocks, the grumpy Morlocks that live underground. We turn up every now and again to eat the humans, or at least chastise them for their bad data and analytics practice.
Yeah, and then disappear in our large time machine with a spinning disc.
Yes, indeed. Yes, don't we all have one of those? But in the absence of time machines with spinning discs, do you have something for us today, Pete?
Yes, well, I was just going to revisit a little on the subject of Marimo notebooks. So I've dived in myself now. I know that you we did one where you talked quite extensively about some of its features and stuff.
So just as a reminder, I started using it, I don't know, God, 6 weeks, 2 months ago, almost on a whim after a podcast or something, and became a fairly immediate convert as Marimo notebooks over what I might previously been using, which was Jupyter Labs, and then prior to that, Jupyter. I can just the news update is I continue to be a convert. I don't even really think about Jupyter now. It doesn't seem to me an option I need to use. Although I'm still running it because I've got a bunch of notebooks in Jupyter that I wouldn't port across. It's just not worth doing.
Yeah.
That I'll refer back to. From time to time, I might run them if they've got something in it that I want, but I don't want to, bother my ass to port it across and make sure it's all Marimo compliant. But yeah, I'm there. I'm with the Marimo crew.
Wow.
I'm on the Marimo bus.
Well, you're ahead of me. I'm literally in both camps, both Jupyter Lab and Marimo Open, partly because I've got quite different use cases, and one of my use cases is I'm comparing code, two sets of code which is doing the same task, so there's usually a lot of overlap in terms of naming, and so comparing two output from two language models, they tend to name things the same, right? It's code, there's nothing exciting going on here. So in Marimo, that immediately causes problems if there's inline definitions and you're not talking functions, because obviously you've got a variable, model two is named, it's variable the same, it's done it inline in the cell, try and run it in Marimo and it complains. So that was the first problem I came across, literally copy code in, run it, okay, it looks good, copy second code in, fail. And I was like, yeah, this is no good. So I know there are ways around it, but I was just like, yeah, I'm not, I'm not trying to flow through here and create a number of cells. You know, I'm not doing, you know, typical sort of analytical. I'm just literally testing two code snippets. So at that point, I just thought, well, I'll dive out here because it's not adding anything, and to work around it, you know, on my first day is probably not worth it. But then I've got millions.
So on that, I think I agree, right? I am the big sort of sticking point with Merino is also it's one of its strongest suits, which is the DAG behind it and its ability to infer the order of things and the precedence of variables and stuff. But if you're doing like comparative stuff like that, or you're just slapping bits of code together, highly experimental, that stuff really slows you down, right? But only in certain circumstances, because I am doing that, but for data exploration, it still holds and it's still pretty strong for me. But I completely see the use case that you've got. I would often, in such a case, because I'm much more likely to do this than you, flip over to just putting it in a module or a script. Because if I'm doing a lot of testing on something where I have to iterate it over it and do different versions of it, especially if I'm working in a modular way, then all the notebooks kind of get in the way of that. It's actually easier just to create yourself a little test script and just run that, because it will set everything up from scratch, which again might be problematic if you're working with the big data sets and stuff. But I think that there's a lesson here in the sense that, you know, it's the right tool for the right job. And the idea that Jupyter was, the go-to for everything was always slightly nonsensical. It was just convenient for many, if not most things. But I found myself increasingly not bothering, because there's extra, all this other cruft around it, when all I want to do is iterate over some code, right? Which part I do it in NeoVim, you know what I mean?
I find myself, part of it is laziness, but I use VS Code where you use Vim. So really I should commit a bit more to that for my snippets. It's just something about the ease of having a cell, drop it in, don't have to worry about your imports because you imported them earlier. Do you know what I mean? The sort of the notebook style, I just got part of that is like, you know, I'm doing it because I like it. I'm already doing extra things I don't need to. So that use case was fairly rubbish. I don't have a problem. Like I say, right tool for the right job. The other use case, though, is classically, running some data analysis, which I was doing the task this week on. And so I was like, right, let's get into Merino. And so I had all those first hour quirks and the redefinition of, you know, variables, as in you define it in one cell, now you can't change it in another. And it crops up in all sorts of weird ways. So I was aware of the data frame one. So I avoided that up front by, copying data frames and then changing when adding columns as you do to add features and so forth, and pivot in different ways and all that sort of stuff. And that was all going fine. That was quite nice. And then I did a quick plot, define some axes as you do in matplotlib. And then I did another plot a bit later on. And of course, for your axes, you use AX equals. It's like, oh, you've already used AX in this cell.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, you've got to be kidding me. But the great thing about Merino is this wonderful button that appears, which is wrap this in a function. Yeah, so literally, it was just a quick plot. So it was nothing flashy. And then you just press this button and just puts it in a underscored function and then runs that for you. So it does exactly the same thing. It just obviously then it wraps the variable. So your AX is now wrapped in a function, so it doesn't pollute the rest of the environment.
I had exactly the same problem for exactly the same reason. And the technique I use is because if you put an underscore in front of the variable in any cell, it becomes local.
Oh, okay.
So you can then, you can then just, I'll now do underscore fig, underscore ax equals subplots, etc. And I can just reuse it. The annoying thing there, though, is then you want to go, well, this is not working. And so you've defined an underscore variable. So oh, let's go have a look, see if I've got the right thing in that variable. So you just want to print it to screen and you go to the next cell and it's going, that variable doesn't exist.
I think, as you said before, this brings on both good, you know, it's annoying, so it's bad, but it kind of brings on good habits. And just even as you mentioned there, doing the underscore first. I mean, you know, one of the Pythonic things to do when you're writing, you know, functions is, you know, if the function's only used internally within a class, for example, is, you know, put an underscore in front of it, you know. And I know I love doing it because I think it makes it really clear for future Heat and Alex that this is just a local function. But I'm not terribly good in doing it. And it's the same with, you know, variables which you're not really going to use down the line. It's quite nice to go, okay, well, look, this has got an underscore. It's just probably going to be used on the next line and that's it. And so it feels like that's a good habit to get into, but I do take it when we're so used to spawning cells, if you like, in order to check previous code, you know, which is one of the benefits. You don't have to keep rerunning the same bit of code and then insert a line and rerun all the code, especially if it starts getting chunky. I don't know whether this is correct, but I start to think about, well, my machine's doing much more well. I don't need to recreate that data frame every time, you know, do a pivot, for example. Or I'm playing around with the columns after the pivot. So let's just take it, you know, from that point and find yourself redoing the pivot. I always feel like I'm wasting a little bit of energy, you know, in the computer and burning up a bit more of the atmosphere.
Yeah.
But it does. You know, Marimo encourages a lot more of that because it's saying, well, you know, you had it all in this cell and then rerun it. And so if you pack too much into a cell, then you're running a lot of code. And then, like you say, if you start to put underscores in to keep stuff local and stop redefinition, then you can't do anything in the next cell. So you're back into the same cell. So, you know, swings around. But I mean, I don't think it's anything hard there. It's just something you get used to.
So I've, I think it was the same time, I also said that I'd migrated largely to Polars.
Yeah.
And Polars is much more aggressively functional than Pandas. And so a lot of the things that Marimo is making it hard for you to do, like df equals and then df equals and then df equals 95 times, they're anti-patterns in both packages. And so this is forcing me to think in terms of functional, right? As opposed to constantly redefining and passing a data frame around explicitly, I just do really long dotted functions because I can't split it out across cells and all this stuff anyway. Oh. And it's also forcing me to be more logical about, I mean, I think we're quite lazy in the type of program we do because our code's, you know, more often than not is disposable.
Yeah.
And we're more often not given, we don't tend to work with huge data. We've got, you know, we can just brute force everything. And why not, right? And sometimes it's better and easier and quicker, especially if you're just doing something one-off and you need it done quick. But this is really sort of forcing better behavior. And it's sort of like a domino effect of virtuous, you know, analysis coding, is that because I'm doing all this stuff functionally, I just remembered the whole lazy interface with Polars.
Woman.
And I'm used to that in terms of working with things like Spark and PySpark and stuff, where you're kind of forced to, but most of the time you just don't think about doing stuff lazily. But it really makes a lot of sense when you're wafting around larger data sets. And it's forcing me to sort of think about getting things done lazily and memory management and all this stuff and working on samples of the data and not, you know, running everything until you're happy with the output. And it's using less memory, burning less CPU cycles, and it's just generally better practice. And once you get into the habit of it, I think there's always a case when you're building up complex pipelines that you kind of end up splitting it up a bit anyway, if not for another reason like debug or whatever. or just because that's the way the thought process went. And you've got a couple of redefinitions that you end up coalescing and stuff. But I'm just doing a lot more of that by default now, which I think is all good practice.
Yeah. I mean, that was one of the things I discovered last year, a year before, was the whole sort of lengthy chaining and using the assign so you can pivot and then assign, add new columns in, and you're doing it essentially all in the same command. And I don't know why that really, really appeals to me. And I love doing it because it just keeps, you know, you're saying, okay, well, I've got some data, I'm going to pivot it because I want it in a different format. And then I go around on this column, you know, I'm creating features from that. This column is this one minus this one. And you do that, and then you rename it and recently in this. You can do that effectively all in one command, and you just dot it and break it over lines. And it just, to me, gives me an incredibly neat bit of code, which you can just follow line by line. You know, it's affecting the data frame that you're transforming, and you're doing all the brain power all in one place, you know. So when you come back and look at it, you're thinking, okay, I'm pivoting it. Why? Well, I'm pivoting it for this reason. Right, now I'm adding this in. Oh, now I've got this calculation here between these two columns. Oh, that makes sense. You know, blah, blah, blah. Then you get the end and you see the print of the table or the data frame, and you're like, okay, yeah, that all makes sense. And for that to be, you know, in a single command or a single chunk of code is neat. And like I say, sometimes you have to split it and do a couple of extra things afterwards. But even so, you still got your data frame, which you're now using over the next, you know, X many cells, is neatly defined, and it's all in one place rather than spreading it out, doing three calculations and then adding a column in after that.
Well, and that is your data definition, right? And it's pretty explicit depending on what you're doing. And you've got one cell, one line of code to interrogate when you want to know what's in there. And we all know the biggest like trap door working with notebooks is, well, particularly Jupyter style notebooks, is, oh yeah, I did this from that cell to, you know, cell 5 to cell 10 to cell 7, and then you randomly redefine something or did a transformation in the middle that is implicit or at least not obvious, and suddenly your data's all wrong, right? And you don't know where the hell the problem is. And we, you know, we spend a lot of time trying to rationalize our, you know, data interchanges so that we don't, you know, that they're reusable and understandable by other people, and that we don't make mistakes like that very often because, you know, because it's easily done, and the notebook paradigm makes it even easier than where we're using a more modular approach. Right. And I think that's really important. I mean, I think these both Polars and Marimo are enforcing something that we basically we end up doing round about the houses anyway, right?
Yes.
And it's just forcing the habit of doing more of it up front, which I think is in the long term is a win.
Yeah. No, definitely. And like you say, when you get to that definition, you know, and we like to push it down into config anyway. So the fact that's always going to be the way we're pushing it anyway. And if you work through and you've got your definition over six cells, then you're going to have to refactor that. And talking of cells is another bugbear, something you might have worked out. So sometimes when you get errors and stuff, and it'll tell you, oh, there's a redefinition in cell 16. And I'm looking at thinking, okay, where's cell 16? Because no, they don't have any.
They're not numbered. Yeah.
Well, I couldn't find the numbering. So mine aren't numbered.
No, they're not numbered. No, but you can give the cells a name explicitly, but they're not numbered. Yeah, I'm with you. It's really annoying.
Yeah, I mean, you can click on it and it'll take you to the cell. So, I mean, you're just slightly annoyed. So that was a little bugbear. It's like saying, oh, you know, you've got a problem on line 15 and you haven't got any line numbers in your code, and you're starting to count down. It's like, yeah, that's not great. Well, I thought that was a sort of major flaw. I thought it'd just be a, you know, like a command L to bring on, or command C to bring on cell numbers. The other thing was, how do you find, you know, the table representation? So I keep saying table, just my mind thinks of data frames, but the data frame representation, where it puts, you know, neatly puts it in columns and gives you little filter things at the top, you know, like much like a sort of internal spreadsheet, which I remember something that the Databricks was doing this in their notebook. But it only displays, well, I can only get mine to display 10 rows or so. Yeah, 10, I think it is.
But so it replaced, well, one of my bugbears with Jupyter was just the chaos when it comes to visualizing data frames and having, if you want more or wider or longer, you have to do something through, you know, config effectively.
Yeah.
You can do it in line. And then, you know, that affects sort of everything, really, when you do that.
Uh-huh.
And it all gets rather horrible, especially if you accidentally, you know, print out a really big data set. What Marimo does is paginate it, right?
Yeah.
And so you can scroll along, go to the beginning, go to the end. At the beginning, it was annoying because I get used to clicking in a cell and just scrolling.
Yeah.
But I don't really see this as dramatically different. And you can jump to the middle. You can, you know, jump to a particular page. And I haven't, you know, once I got used to the fact that I couldn't just click in and scroll, I'm more than happy with it. Having the filters on the columns or the ordering on the columns is great.
Yep.
Having the little histograms where it's available is really cool.
Yeah.
At the top of the columns. There's a lot of plugins in the Jupyter land that will do something like that. And as you mentioned, Databricks has that as well. Did have it. I think it still does. So I'm sort of all down with all of that. I quite like the way that it does it. It's quite clear. And actually, it's also pretty good at just printing tables out as well as opposed to just visualizing them. So I'm a convert on that too.
Yeah, no, I just find when you got, 15 rows, I want to see them all on the same, like you say, yeah, just on the same screen. But like I say, it's not a big one. And the only other thing which I came across was a little bit of a gotcha was, yeah, again, with a matplotlib and, the inline command that you use in Jupyter.
Yeah.
So that a cell will automatically display it, which doesn't do here. You have to do on a plot. GCA or show.
You need plot show. Well, I mean, Jupyter's like the only environment you get away without plot show.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And I just don't care. You know what I mean? It's one line of code different. And in some ways, that's sort of limiting, right? Because you don't necessarily always want it to show. You might want to split your definition over multiple cells, right?
Yeah.
At which point you have to turn that off for the whole notebook. So I don't miss that.
Mm-hmm.
And also it's because, natively, Marimo wants to use Altair, right? Or does Marimo use Altair? I think Marimo wants to use Altair. It's got a lot closer integration with that.
Okay.
And a lot of the time I end up using Seaborn or something anyway. I'll never migrate away from my, you know, the ugly child that is matplotlib. I've got an affection for the old, it's like an old mangy dog, but like a really big dog that's been hanging around for a long time, and it does everything you need. But, you know, he's a bit scruffy and old now, isn't he? But I love him.
Yeah.
I'm going to call my next dog when we get one, matplotlib, I think. We'll do it. Be an old St. Bernard or something.
Slurring everywhere.
Yeah.
Well, so with that, I think that's about it at the moment. I mean, you get the teething problems, some of the ways that cells, you know, you can copy bits, you know, some of the commands a bit different. So, you know, you have that sort of muscle memory of doing a control something and doesn't do anything or keeps popping up a window. Might give me a window, otherwise it's supposed to be command, you know, enter to run it and stay in the cell. But Sort of getting there. I'm quite liking it. I don't, like you say, I don't see any reason for a straightforward data analysis why I wouldn't continue with it. So yeah, quite liking it.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah, I've been using the inline documentation, which is quite nice. I've got all sorts of little bits I keep discovering. It's quite nice when you're adopting a new tool like this, where you keep finding new things. So it's like there's lots of, it's like an Easter egg hunt. There's lots of new things turning up, and not everything works brilliantly, but it's quite nice. And the AI function's quite handy sometimes.
Yeah.
It's, as ever with AI, a little bit of a mixed bag. Marimo wins. That's the decision. I've called it. Since I'm talking about AI or Gen AI, it brings us on to our second subject of the day, which is, drum roll, MCP, which is Model Context Protocol. And we talked about this, I guess, a couple of weeks ago. We both wanted to talk about this week. So this is a bit of a double header. I was going to use another euphemism there that's probably even inappropriate for this podcast, so I won't. So from my point of view, you mentioned MCPs.
Yep.
I hadn't heard of it. All sounded very good. Forgot about it. Then, my ongoing love affair with Warp Terminal.
Yeah.
Did an update where they said you can put your own MCP servers in there, so you can do MCPing in line on your command line. And I was like, oh, I remember this MCP. That sounds interesting. New shiny things. Let's go and noodle around with that. And so that's what I've been, and failing really badly to get anything useful. But it's mainly because I was just pissing around on the side when I was we had a weekend away in Belfast, and I was sort of doing it when I was trying to not pay attention to anything else going on. So I didn't get very far with it, but I'm with it. I'm down with it. So I've got a particular use case I want to try out, but I'll come back to it.
Yeah.
What brings you back to this subject?
Just before I jump into my bit, probably just quick recap on MCP, another three-letter one to remember. And I don't know, do you want to give a quick summary of what you think it does? What's the gap it's filling?
It's all a little bit abstract. In terms of how I think about what it really is, but on the surface, it's really just a middle layer protocol. Hesitate to use the word middleware.
Yeah.
Between you and your local application. So think you might have just like a web chat portal. It could be one of the various third party LLM, but it could be your your IDE or your text composer thingy.
Yeah.
And it allows for interfacing with known products and services like APIs or databases that is context aware product aware.
Mm-hmm.
So and can learn about the use case I've got is probably the most obvious one, which is I have a Postgres database with a fairly complicated schema, and I hate writing SQL, I just want to be able to say, give me all of the customers with XYZ, right?
Yeah.
Which is spread across multiple tables, blah, blah, blah. And I should be able to point my client, an MCP, a Model Context Protocol server, which will have the information about that particular database, will have learned its structure, and will be able to facilitate me using natural language queries against my SQL-based database, right? So you can imagine a similar thing for other sort of data APIs, or, you know, any of your sort of API-based services, and there's billions of them. GitHub is another major use case for it.
Yeah.
So natural language GitHub, which I think for me, I hate Git. I hate it. Because I don't have a bloody clue what's going on. So to be able to have something, you know, be able to sort my Git out for me, can you just make all this stuff happen? Can you reverse all the horrors that I've just done to this repository is really what I want.
Yeah.
Because I typed in lots of random Git commands thinking, oh, this sounds like it does the right thing. And, you know, balked my whole repo.
Yeah. Turned out you were wrong.
Yes.
Yeah. No, there were two things really around that. The first one was that on this week's Practical AI podcast, the guys go into detail and have a very good description of it and use the term middleware, which they're also uncomfortable about because I think it has connotations from about 20 years ago. And yeah, they put it very succinctly, as you did. It's a layer that sits between, I think the official documentation talks about something like functions, data, or prompts. So in other words, a service you can offer, and your local tool that, like, you've got it embedded in. And the part of the reason why is because people were, which I'll get onto in a second, people were starting to write code in that middleware because if you're in a company, like you say, you've got data coming out of your Postgres, and you're writing a whole bunch of code to make that happen, maybe to create some specific APIs specific to your business. And then you've got this, you know, some data science team, they say, oh yeah, we've got this shiny tool, we want to get access to that. And where you've got an API, oh, and now they've got to sort of write an in-betweeny tool. And this protocol sits in between to say, well, you can expose your API to the MCP layer. And so you'll have to use a certain, you know, format and types of commands. And then the client, the other side, when they're calling to get the data, also goes through MCP. So again, you're formatted in a certain way and think things like HTTP, so, you know, gets posts, all that sort of stuff. And so you get a formalization of two potentially different teams or two different companies of providing a service without getting very, very specific around how one company wrote an API against how another company wrote an API, because you're just calling a common protocol in the middle. And they go into quite a bit of detail and explain it really well. So the first thing I was really chuffed about was that we called it a couple of weeks before they got into it.
Woo, always ahead of the curve.
Yeah, exactly. But the other one was really, you know, well, what does it mean and kind of why it exists in that middle bit? And again, it was something that we've been talking about for some time. You know, I've played around with the LLM's calling tools, and they talk about kayak.com, which I think is a travel website. And I think that they're published as having done this, you know, sort of publicly. So they've got an LLM and they feed it the details of their APIs. And then, so by that you mean all the different endpoints that the API can call, plus descriptive details about what they do. And then when they receive a human language inquiry, they convert that inquiry or that action into API calls. And then effectively, you know, kind of like having a sort of programmer in between, then go and make those API calls and therefore get back specific data or perform specific tasks according to the API, so it should work and do what you want and you get a result back, rather than the LLM kind of trying to struggle to do it itself or get it wrong or whatever. So it starts to create this layer of structure, and that's, you know, something we've talked about in the past, that having an LLM sit over the top of that seems like a good idea. And that led me into this whole idea of this sort of definition of AI, because we think AI, and then we go, okay, well, what we mean by that is a model, and we know there are limitations to these large language models. And if it's calling an API and the API is doing the work, then we're saying, well, hold on, it's just, that's coding. Someone went and created that API and wrote it, and it's conforming. So it's not really the AI. But I was thinking that from an end user point of view, they kind of don't care. I mean, certainly people I speak to, whether I'm saying, oh yeah, you go and ask ChatGPT and it'll do everything for you, or whether you ask this insert new name of a multiple layered agent or whatever you want to call it. Well, it's the same thing as far as they're concerned. Well, I'll just type something in, it comes back with the answer. Now, we know there's a whole ecosystem in there, but everyone else just thinks, oh yeah, it's AI. And I think it's probably a little bit of annoyance on our part. Sometimes we think, yeah, well, it's not really AI. But I sort of feel like we're splitting hairs a bit in there. And I sort of see, if MCP or something like it takes off, and all this talk about agents and the agentic layer, which is a great new expression, it makes total sense to me, i.e. there's an ecosystem that has AI in it as well as a bunch of other tools. And the problem is it's going to get branded as AI. And we've got to be purists saying, yeah, well, there's loads of other layers in. What do you think?
So I think lots of things. how many hours have you got? So the MCP is like a universal bus sits between us, models and applications. And in that way, it's like a database abstraction layer or any number of other things, any number of facilitation or interchange layers. And from a historically tech history perspective, it's all very mundane, right? Well, and as you point out, people were sort of creating their own middleware solutions, and that was not sustainable. This one, MCP, comes specifically for Anthropic. So it's not proprietary, it's open. But I've no doubt that other protocols will spring up. And this is all bloody marvelous. And this whole conversation feeds straight into my point that I made various times, which is AI isn't an ends, it's a means, right? It's a component. It isn't the thing itself. Because people don't think in terms of software, they think in terms of things that need doing, right?
Yeah.
If you're going to make a coffee table, which I am at the moment, funny enough, you don't think in terms of the tools. You think in terms of the endpoint and what you want to achieve. And I've got, hammers and chisels, I've got saws, I've got electric saws and sanders and all these sorts of things. I'm going to use any number of all of these things, right? And I think that there was for a while, this sort of point of view that you ask something of Gen AI through this, text box, and it would be able to do anything for you. And actually it can't, right? And this is the distinction that you're drawing, because what it can do is generate some code or something that can then do that thing, but you have to join the dots for it, right? What's happening now that the industry is becoming a bit more mature is that they're joining those dots, right? But what are you going to end up with, right? You're not going to end up with the Google of Gen AI that performs any agentic function that you want to do, because people don't use Google that way. They don't expect Google to be able to do everything for you. And even if you stay within the Google ecosystem, I'm going to search for X. I've got to write a PowerPoint presentation about X, so I'm going to get Google Slides. You know what I mean? I need to make some notes. I've got Google Notes. You don't think, oh, Google did it all for me, right?
Yeah.
You think that I had this thing to do, and Google provided me the tools to do it. Now, you add a layer of AI on that. Can you rustle up some slides? Can you do some of the research, blah, blah, blah? The final product is still yours. Still you did it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the reason we get pedantic is because it seems to suggest that our role in this is redundant, right? Say, as analysts, because people can just go ask questions of things and the AI supposedly does it. And we're like, no, that thing's just doing what we do. It's just automating it, which of course is beside the point as well, right?
Yeah.
Because of course, you know, if you can automate our job away, then that's what's going to happen. Now, the problem is it's not going to happen, right? Not anytime soon, simply because analysis isn't all about, you know, tools and programming and SQLs and Pythons and stuff. There's a lot more to it than that, which brings me back to my use case, which is actually exactly the same use case that the guy in the Practical AI podcast used, yes, which is natural language database queries.
Yeah.
And so to the degree that you can get an agent on top of a database to allow non-technical users to query, I'm all there, right? I'm totally there. Does that make me redundant? Hell no, right? Partly because are they asking the right questions? Are they getting the right responses? And do they know what to do next? Do they know what's possible? And will the agent be able to really help them with that? And do they want to do that, right?
Yeah.
Because these people have lots of things they need to do. And so sitting there having a chat with a model about, you know, their database, I think is, you know, it's not something that people are prepared to do. And I also think that the limitation in that is in the underlying database, because at some point you're going to hit something that not even, you know, the best analyst can do, because the data's structured wrong or the data's not there, right? So you're always going to need a group of people that understands that data set, right? And how to re-engineer that and how to add to it and keep it stable. You've just been created by using natural language queries that presumably can come back with charts and stuff. What you've not replaced is analysts. What you've replaced is dashboards, right? What you've replaced is high level analysts and probably like BI technicians, right? But even saying all of this in the back of my mind, you know, there's a little demon going, you know, well, that's not true, right? You know. You know they're going to replace you, right? You know this sooner than you think. So I don't know, but yeah, I think, I don't know. I forgot the question. What were we talking about?
Well, it plays to me. I think, you know, what you said, that it plays to me into the, and perhaps this is a bias from my side, into the expression of, you know, you won't lose your job to AI. You'll lose it to someone using AI. Because...
Yeah.
Because I was thinking about the use cases that you could get from this, you know, and as you say, and they talk about the progression from, okay, you've got a large language model, okay, I want to use my data, so then I use RAG to, access my data. Now I've created some tools and some APIs, and now I've got some agents which access that. Now I've got an LLM sitting over the top, and I'm using this protocol. And, you know, each level is getting more sophisticated. And then you're throwing, yeah, it's going to get some stuff wrong, right? So, and you don't know when that's going to be and what question it's going to come to. So, yeah, as we spoke about before, do you want to roll this out to your 67 million customers, or do you want to give it to a couple of hundred internal people? Yeah, you know, I know where my risk sits. And, you know, I can see internal people using, a SQL creator, but even that you can see, but where you're going to run into trouble. So you get the keeny beanie business guy. He starts asking questions and this thing's chunking out some decent SQLs, getting him a load of data, and he's pulling some other data in, and then he's putting this in, then he's always getting a correlation on it. Then he's adding in the next bit. Then he's moving in some more data. Oh, this is great. Put it in some slides, goes to his manager or board meeting, pulls all this data. Someone says, wow, if that's really true, we ought to do X. And someone says, well, okay, should we get this checked? And someone's got to go and unpick it. And it turns out that the LLM made a whole load of, you know, mini mistakes in there. And when you add it all up, it misunderstood something, got the wrong data, told them it was this, put it into that table, gave it this name, but it was actually wrong. oh, and actually that's all disappeared and it doesn't actually make any sense. Yeah, that's limited if that's internal. That's a nightmare if that's out directly with customers, you know. And
well,
you can't, not going to do that. You know, that's not going to happen. You know what I mean?
Well, this is it. I disagree with the idea that Mr. Keeney McBeany is actually going to do half the stuff you said, right?
Well, because he is very keen.
Yeah, and how many of them you ever met, right? and actually, you know, you talk about all this and that is correlated. Is that people just don't think in these terms, right? And so yeah, maybe the agent can make a suggestion. Well, perhaps we should see if X and Y are correlated. A lot of people will probably largely misunderstand what they mean. You've got the correlation causation nightmare, and so I think there's a level of sophistication in, you know, so what you're alluding to there, that we can't and shouldn't expect business users to be generally capable of. And if you have got a business user out there that's that sophisticated, then you don't need us anyway, right?
Yeah.
Which is fine, but that's never going to be the majority ever, right? Because doing proper analysis takes time, it takes effort, it takes consideration, it takes thoroughness. And I just don't think we're anywhere close to that being handoffable to a language model. And no one's got the time in their job to do this properly, right?
Yeah.
And that's why we exist. So I don't think it's going to get we're going to get taken over by the robots. What I do see is that if you can give me an MCP and I can allow natural language queries to my database, I'm going to be really happy. Do I give that to my business users? Well, it depends on how happy I get, right? Yeah. Because if it doesn't work for me, it damn well ain't going to work for them. And you know, we need to do an episode on this. I want to do the case for and against SQL session at some point, because I'm just a grumpy old bastard. I hate SQL. I hate writing it. Drives me nuts. And it's just ubiquitous.
Yeah.
And so I'm always looking for ways to not do it. Part of the reason I do everything in data frames is so I don't have to deal with SQL, right? And then you've got stuff like Marimo or whatever that will do SQL natively. And all the various big data platforms. I'm like, no, I thought we'd moved away from this.
Right.
So having a natural language to SQL interface for me personally I would consider high fives all round. I think I would need to really step back and think about whether or not that could be used for the end users. But you know, it is. Some of the end users I'm working with at the moment have expressed an explicit desire for this.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, there is demand, because some of these use cases for LLMs, you go, who wants that? Right. But I've got explicit demand for this. And I'm like, whoa, this should be interesting.
Yeah. No, I mean, I've definitely worked in businesses where they have, this sort of, term them business technical people who kind of sit as a layer, you know, usually not a big team, but they, you know, they have access to databases and they pull queries in, they run queries, and it's almost like their role is to, you know, answer business questions, and they're writing SQL. And for them, and anybody sitting in that sort of layer who is servicing a wider team by writing SQL to slice and dice and extract data, this would be a great tool for them, because it means they're going to be able to service more, because they should be able to write more queries in less time, right? And that's what I'm saying. As a, you know, it's not going to do people out of a job. It's going to make them be able to service more people. So, you know, it's a good tool for the internal.
Well, so I've worked with such people. Mm-hmm. Right. And I just see them on, I don't see them on the as a continuation of the business. I can see them on, well, I can't even talk. I don't consider them on the business continuum. I see them on the analysis continuum, right? And what I see is that these guys are doing stuff with SQL, realizing the limitations of that, given the way that their data is shaped, creating mountains of like scratch pad tables and into the free for all schemas, because they figured out, well, if I can get all this staged in this table and I can join this new table with that new table, and then suddenly in production you've got some weird sandbox table being referenced by sort of production reporting systems and shit. And it's all wrong, right? The reason we have data frames is so you don't need to do that, right? And but these people are already trying to behave like we do, right? To do the things that we do. And it takes them much longer because databases are not good for this, right? With, an agent on top of it. And, I don't disagree. I think you're right. These people are going to benefit from it. If it's freed them up to do more stuff, it should free them up to do the stuff that we do, to learn more and to understand more sophisticated ways of working with the data, in which case they may be working agentically with a Python Polars backend or DuckDB or something, which does away with the need for doing everything within a database server, which is, where they see their progression as, because a lot of them haven't really come at it from a more technical side like we have, right? Yes. But, that type of person I would want to be upskilling in sort of data wrangling manipulation as we do it, and, stats and proper rigor and hypothesis testing and all this stuff, right? Yeah. So I think those people exist as our opportunity to bridge the gap between us and the business. But the idea that the agents, entrench them in that way of working, that's not right. That's not what should be happening.
Yeah, agreed. It's all coming, and so we'll see how well we can train these people up and to bring them over to the dark side.
It's just like a big juggernaut careening down the motorway, looking sort of out of control. We are but cars swerving out of the way to try and protect ourselves, and maybe we'll jump on the side of it, chuck the driver out, and end up driving it ourselves.
Maybe.
Well, that's my plan anyway, like Indiana Jones style. I'll end up being dragged underneath it for a bit. That's probably what's happening at the moment.
Exactly.
AI. Enough of that. Actually, I've got more to do with MCP. I'm going to try and get this thing up and running. I got to a point where I keep on plugging it into Warp and Warp going, I don't know what to do with this. So I clearly just don't know what I'm doing. So when I've got something up and running and I've had a play with it, we'll revisit, right? Yeah,
sounds good.
And I've no doubt you'll do something similar yourself. In the meantime, I think next week we're going to try and do something on hypotheses.
Yeah,
but good. I don't hold us to that because we're fickle beasts.
We do.
And if anything really interesting turns up in the meantime, maybe we do that instead. But currently the plan is to talk about hypotheses, and I've got a fun little activity that we're going to do.
Right.
How excited are you feeling about that?
Well, very exciting.
Well, I can't imagine you would ever find anything more exciting. Enjoy the sunshine.
Yeah, and you, wall to wall. And see you next time. Bye.
Yeah, see ya. Bye.
The confusion matrix.